Welcome, welcome, welcome back to the Bob Left Sets podcast. My guest today is musician Warren Ames. Warren?
How are you?
I'm good. Okay, so where are you right now in this coronavirus era?
I am in Westchester County, New York.
And how many people are in the house with you?
Myself, my wife, my eight-year-old son, and he has a nanny that has been with us the entire time, so we're all kind of quarantined together.
How do you feel about being this age and having an eight-year-old kid?
You know, that's a good point. I became a dad at 50, which was, I don't know if it's recommended or not. In my case, it worked out really good because I was on the road so much for most of my life that I never really wanted to be a MIA dad. And so now I'm able to spend a lot more time with him, starting when he was born, and especially now than I ever have. I'm at home more than I've been in the past 30 years.
And other than the coronavirus situation, why are you at home more?
Well, once he was born, I started kind of tailoring my schedule a little bit to spend more time at home and to make it where I could come back and forth more often and that sort of thing. But, you know, it's a challenge just connecting the dots. But I love being a dad in my, I was going to say 50s, but I just turned 60.
So how did you pull the trigger? What was the thought process after 50 years?
Luck, I guess.
So, you turned 60. I turned 60 at this point 7 years ago. Really fucked me up. I found 50 was no big deal. How 60?
Well, 60 was a little intimidating and still is. But the fact that I spent my 60th birthday quarantined and with just the four of us was a little surreal in a bizarre way. My wife and I had talked 6 months earlier or something about, okay, are we going to make a big deal out of it? We're going to bring in friends and family and have a big blowout. And by the time it all came around, that wasn't really meant to be. And then when my birthday actually happened, it's like, oh, happy birthday. We're the three of us are having a great time.
Now, I just remember literally starting around the time of my birthday, and I didn't anticipate it, turning 60, a lot of shit that was meaningful before suddenly wasn't meaningful anymore. I guess I realized at some point I would die. Have there been any emotional changes turning 60?
Well, yeah, and I don't know how much is attributed to turning 60 and how much is attributed to the coronavirus, because they're right. The same thing for me, which I don't recommend.
Okay, so going back to your son, you were talking about your road work. How many, forgetting coronavirus, how many days a year are you on the road now?
Prior to this, probably 100 to 150.
Okay, and once your kid started to go to school, your kid stays home or your kid comes with you? How do you work that?
He stays home except when it is convenient for him to come for a few days. And then I just find myself coming back and forth a lot more often, which is fine, but it's a lot of, if we have 2 days off, I'll go home for 2 days and go back on the road for 4 or 5 days and then come back home for 2 more days, which is a lot of wear and tear, but definitely worth it.
Now, you're really seen as a road dog. So how are you filling this time?
Well, it's been a bit of adapting. I'm writing a lot, which is great. That's one of the few upsides. But in the beginning, just a lot of kind of thinking about how to reinvent and how to kind of reinterpret the whole situation. Gradually, I'm getting my setup more and more together where I can do more playing and recording and stuff. But in the beginning, I was mostly just writing on acoustic guitar and writing a lot of lyrics and taking advantage of that. I don't think I've written this much since 1987.
Okay, so prior to the COVID situation, did you have a home studio?
Only a small one. There's a studio close by that I work in a lot, and I've been, for the past 3 years, trying to either build, buy, a studio of my own, which has been an ever-changing process. It's a work in progress. My ability to record here is limited, but getting less limited. But it's really making me think of things differently. Like I haven't been to the studio that I normally record in. I haven't been there since the coronavirus.
Are you pretty tech savvy now that you're alone without an engineer? Are you familiar with Pro Tools or Logic or any of that other stuff?
No, you know, I've been telling myself that I needed to learn Pro Tools for years now. And of course, this is going to be a great opportunity. I'm going to have to force myself to do it.
Okay. Talk about the writing process. Do you normally write songs, or do you say, pick out a window, this is when I'm going to write a song, or you wait for inspiration? What's your normal routine?
I usually wait for inspiration. I'm not one of those people that writes every day or can force myself to write. I know some people have good luck with that, but I might go 2 or 3 months without writing at all. And every time that happens, I start getting this feeling of anxiety of, have I written my last song? And then eventually I'll write something, and then another one will come pretty quickly, and another one will come pretty quickly, and I realize that I'm back on the wave. But more often than not, it starts with a lyrical idea. I find it easier to write music based on a lyric that already exists than vice versa. Now, having said that, in the past 6 or 8 years, I've been trying to do the opposite just to not fall into the pattern and to shake things up a little bit. But I really enjoy working that way. What I tend to notice is that the up-tempo songs start with the music, and the mid-tempo and down-tempo songs usually start with the lyric.
Okay, so give me an example of how you would latch onto a lyric.
Usually just some sort of thought happens randomly, and I decide if I like it or not. And these days I'm mostly writing on the computer as opposed to by hand. I do a lot of stream of consciousness writing. And if the initial thought appears to me in a way that I feel like it's a hook or a title, then maybe that gives me some sort of incentive or direction. If it's just a clever idea or something that taps into me emotionally, then I just start writing until it starts feeling forced, or until something appears that sounds like a chorus, or, you know, every situation is different. I know Greg Allman used to say there's as many ways to write a song as there are songs.
Okay, what is your motivation for writing songs? Is it something you say, I'm an artist, I have to do it? Or is it something you would do even if you weren't releasing music? Or it's about having something to say? What makes you write songs?
I'm more grateful for being able to write songs than just about anything else in the world. It's therapy for me. It's a creative outlet. It's something, it's a learning challenge. I feel like the majority of the stuff that I write, most people will never hear. And that's kind of bizarre, but there have been a lot of songs that I wound up releasing at some point that started out as just a personal song that I feel like I wrote for myself. I'd never think of it like I need to write, or what can I do to write a song that more people will tap into or that will make money. Or I never think like that. I write the song first and then think about later, A, is it any good? B, is it something I could do? Is it something someone else can do? I don't even think about the categorization of the tune until it's finished normally.
So let's go back to the beginning. You're from North Carolina, right?
Yes.
Where in North Carolina?
Asheville.
Now, Asheville, it's kind of in the mountains. They got a ski area. They have a rich person and a house there. You know, what was it like growing up in Asheville?
Well, when I was growing up there, it wasn't the bohemian capital of the South that it is now. That's been the past 15 or 20 years that transition happened. When I was growing up, a lot of great musicians, mostly guitar players, a lot of bluegrass, a lot of folk music, and a lot of art and a cool art scene, but it was much more underground, unlike now where it's everywhere. It was always a cool place, you know, being in the mountains is beautiful. It's geographically beautiful, really great people. But I've watched it kind of turn into what Austin is to Texas, Asheville is to North Carolina now.
Okay, so you grew up, what'd your parents do for a living?
My parents divorced when I was 8, and I was mostly raised by my dad, who worked in a grocery store. They were both, they both grew up on farms in Polk County, North Carolina, and then moved to the big city of Asheville.
Okay, just starting with Asheville, if you want to leave Asheville and go to the big city, what big city would you go to?
Well, initially, Nashville was the closest one.
And that's how far away?
5 hours by car.
Not close.
Yeah, not close, but much closer than New York or L.A.
That's for sure.
So I went to Nashville late 83, lived there.
Okay, but before we get there, let's say,
okay,
your parents get divorced. Before they got divorced, were you the only kid or were there other kids?
I have two older brothers.
Two older brothers. How much older?
3 years and 5 years.
Okay. Your parents divorce. It's relatively uncommon for the kids to go with the father.
Yeah.
What was the thought process there?
You know, I was so young that I wasn't such a big part of it, but it was unheard of in the South at that time, or anywhere, but especially in the South at that time. Divorce was unheard of, much less the dad getting the kids. I guess there was enough justification at that time for my dad insisted that it be that way, which for him meant working all day long and raising three boys, which is just an unbelievable task.
Okay. Was there ever a stepmother or stepfather?
My mom remarried. I had a stepfather who passed away a little over a year ago.
Okay. And did you continue to have contact with your mother growing up?
We lost touch for a short period of time, not much. And it was a hard thing to get used to. But we eventually became closer and closer. It was a bizarre situation for myself because my dad, when I was really young, my dad was working all the time. So it was me and my mom at home. And then when she was gone, that changed completely. So it was hard for me to adjust to. My older brothers did a little better job adjusting, I think. But she moved about an hour away, so we would visit a lot, but you know, it was not your normal Ozzie and Harriet type of situation.
Well, looking back at this age, deep into your life, do you think your mother leaving to a great degree affected you in certain ways that have sustained, affected your adulthood?
Yeah, I'm sure it did. I'm sure it had a lot to do with my gravitating towards music and poetry and songwriting and traveling and all the things that I chose, you know. But at the time, I don't think you can ever really know what motivates that. But yeah, I think so.
You ever go to therapy?
No, I think I've thought about it a lot in recent years, but never done it. And I think songwriting has kind of been my therapy, and I've always felt like without it, or music in general, but songwriting especially, music has been so therapeutic for me that I think without it, I have no idea how adjusted I would be.
Okay, so you're going to school. Are you a popular kid? Are you good in school? What's that experience like?
I was semi-popular, you know, not mainstream, but the musician circle that I ran in, there were several of us that had some sort of popularity. I surprisingly was a good student. I graduated in the top 5% of my class and was in the National Honor Society. had scholarship offers that I turned down, which I think shocked my dad, but he was supportive.
Okay. So was there music in the house growing up?
Yeah. My dad listened to Hank Williams and Bill Monroe and Merle Haggard and George Jones, Ralph Stanley, stuff like that. My two older brothers have amazing taste in music and had tons of records, eventually thousands of records, and eventually my middle brother collected to the point that he started a record store of used and new records and did that for about 25 years. And to this day, I think he's got thousands of records, although he closed the store a while back.
Okay. How old were you when he opened the store?
I guess I was in my 20s.
Okay. So you were already out of the house.
Yeah.
Okay. So when do you first play a musical instrument?
I started singing probably around 7 or 8. And thanks to my older brothers, they had all this great soul music, the Temptations and the Four Tops and Sam and Dave and Wilson Pickett. I think James Brown was my first hero. We had, at a time when we only had a handful of records, it was the best of Aretha Franklin, the best of Stevie Wonder, the best of the Four Tops, you know, all that stuff. And they also had the Beatles and the Stones. And the fact that they had so many records just kind of gave me this library to dig through. My oldest brother got a guitar when I was 11, and I played it more than he did, so I got my own guitar when I was 12.
Okay, you say you were singing, like singing in school?
Yeah, sang in the school chorus and in church in the beginning when I actually went to church. But mostly in my bedroom, you know, trying to sound like Wilson Pickett, but sounding more like Smokey Robinson.
Okay. So you pick up the guitar, your brother's guitar, when you were 11. You ever have lessons?
I took a handful of lessons from this guy named Andy Hunter, who was a local blues guitar player who was really great. But he was self-taught. And so after a few lessons, he kind of pulled me aside and said, hey, you know, most of my students don't even practice in the 6 days between lessons. I can tell you're really serious about this. You should probably just stay on the path of teaching yourself, which is kind of the weirdest, most honest thing
right.
for someone to say, putting him out of work. But I think the fact that he was self-taught made him look at it that way. I learned a lot from him. And one of the things that stuck with me was his fascination for what he considered the three kings, Freddie, B.B., and Albert. He said, if you listen to those three guys your whole life, you still can't learn it all. So that stayed with me.
So how did you teach yourself?
Just records, skipping the needle back and playing to records. At some point, I bought a music theory book and just started studying that on my own. And in high school, I took a one semester course of music theory, but mostly there were a circle of musicians that were teaching each other how to play and playing together. And we were all starting bands before we could even play, which I think looking back was probably a good thing because we learned how to play music together, which is very important.
Okay. Did you immediately, I knew from the era we all and everybody in my generation, a little bit older than you, played guitars, but it was clear. I remember pretty much giving up when a friend of mine said, hey, we're going to change keys. And I said, well, wait a second. This is a little too much for me. So did you, it's always hard work to be great, but did you feel you had a natural affinity for it?
I did. I felt like I had an affinity for it. You know, I think everybody, when they first start, they think this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. But then that feeling dissipates at some point in a year or two, and you start kind of losing interest. I just never started losing interest. The interest increased, and as I got better, I kind of faced the fact that the more I learned, the more I wanted to do it. And then when I was 14, there was a little folk club down the street, and I would sneak in there when the drinking age was 18 at that time, and I would sneak in and hear these folk musicians, and it was just amazing hearing live music like that in a small environment. And then eventually the word got out that I played guitar, so somebody asked me to get up and play, and I did, and then I was hooked. That's what I wanted to do all the time.
So you got up and played. What'd you play?
Some blues or something. At that time, the stage in that club, you couldn't put a drum kit on there. You could only have two or three stringed instruments or something. But there were a couple of people playing electric guitar, and one of them gave me their electric guitar, and I just played along and just remember. I have a visual recollection of that now, and how it felt as well. And it was just an amazing feeling, something to tap into, something to be part of that I had never experienced before.
And what was the reaction? Did anybody say, "Hey, kid, you're good. Stay at it"?
Yeah, there was a lot of encouragement. You know, the local musician scene was very encouraging to me, and so I would go there all the time, and I met more and more of the local musicians, and they would all get me up to play, and that's where I really developed this appreciation for folk music and for songwriting in general, because a lot of those local guys were fantastic songwriters, and they were doing their own material, and that was a revelation as well, that these guys are writing their own songs and they're really good. Then they would also be playing Dylan songs and John Prine songs and stuff like that. But it was turning me onto this world of music that I was ready for.
So what was your first guitar?
The first guitar I had was called a Norma. There was a Norma amp. $49 and $59 respectively. And my dad got them at the local hardware store.
And how long did it take to graduate from that?
I think probably a year or so. I got a copy of a Gibson SG that was $100 about a year later. And then about a year after that, I got a real Gibson SG Junior. And my dad was really good about upgrading, and just as long as I didn't lose interest, he would continue to make sure I had a little bit better guitar, a little bit better amp, you know.
Well, I grew up in Connecticut. We would go into New York to 48th Street, 47th Street, whatever it was, and buy. Where did you actually buy this stuff? You're in North Carolina.
Well, there was a music store, oddly enough, a few blocks from my house, and when I would ride the bus to and from school, that's where we would get on and off. The bus was on that corner where the music store was. And so at the end of the day, the two or three people that were in my circle of musician friends, we would get off the bus and immediately go into the music store and just geek out and look at everything and annoy the people that ran it, you know, and let's try this, let's try that, and spend hours in there, which in hindsight must have been really annoying, but they were so supportive and nice. And they, of course, we're friends now, but we literally spent hours of our day in the music store just playing instruments, you know.
And when did you start forming bands?
Early. I think almost at the very beginning. You know, we were designing album covers and, you know, every crazy thing that kids do. The first time I think we played in public, there were a few things, like we played a walk-a-thon where these poor people that had just walked 20 miles when they were done, they got like free punch and to sit and listen to us play. And it must've been very painful, but they were a captive audience. You know, we played a few things. They were all free gigs in the beginning. We would just play anywhere anybody would have us, you know.
And what material were you playing?
Oh, my goodness. Back then, just whatever was going on at the time, where it be Grand Funk Railroad, could be, you know, oddly enough, when I was 14 or 15, we had a band called Blue Sky that was named after the Allman Brothers song, and we had two drummers. And so how foreshadowing is that? I mean,
unbelievable.
You know, we played a handful of Allman Brothers songs, but we played a lot of other stuff as well. But we were big enough fans to call our band that.
So you graduate from high school and you tell your father what's the path then?
I want to go on the road and play music and not go to college. And he was, I'm sure, extremely disappointed because I would have been the first person in our family to go to college. But he said, if that's what you want to do and you're going to give it everything you got, then you have my blessing. But, and he was always supportive that way. I'm not sure that I would make the same decision, given that decision to make now, you know, for his decision. I mean, you know, if it were my son, I'm not sure I would be so understanding.
Well, let's just say hypothetically, if you had gone to college, what would have been different for you?
Good question. You know, because a lot of bands start in college, you know, especially, the New York scene. When I came to New York in 1990, bands like Blues Traveler and the Spin Doctors and, of course, the Dave Matthews Band in Virginia, all those bands started out playing together in college and started a scene at their college. So maybe I would have done that, but had I gone to college, I would have probably gone into some sort of creative writing, journalism type situation, because that's what all my teachers were pushing me toward. None of them were pushing me toward music.
Okay, you started writing songs relatively immediately after you went to the folk club?
Even prior, I would say, but really terrible, like horrible songs. But from the very beginning, I was writing songs, if you could call it that. I started writing poetry before I picked up guitar. So as soon as I started playing guitar, that just changed to song lyrics. And I would hate to go back and have to face up to whatever those songs were now, but
unlike a lot of musicians, it wasn't the case even with the Stones. Well, we're going to make a record. You should write your own material. You were writing your own material at the beginning, even before the Dream.
Yeah. You know, I guess, bands from an earlier era started out doing covers, but the era I was influenced by at that time, I guess everybody was mostly writing their own music, and in my head, that's what you did. You know.
Okay, so you say you went to Nashville when you were 23. What happened from 18 when you graduated from high school to 23?
I was in a band locally. There was a band called Ricochet that was kind of a Southern rock type band. I was the youngest member of that band, and we were trying to get a record deal with no clue as to how to go about that. And that band went through a few incarnations and broke up several times. And then at the end, when the last incarnation reformed, we did our very first gig. And the same day that we played our first gig, I had gotten a phone call from this guy that was playing in David Allan Coe's band. And he said, "We're looking for a guitar player. Are you interested?" And I didn't really know much about Coe. I didn't know his music. But it seemed like a step up. And so after our first reformed gig, I went to the guys and said, "Hey, I think I'm going to take this gig," and got on a plane and flew to Baton Rouge, Louisiana, Christmas Eve, and joined a situation that I was totally unprepared for.
Okay, just to do a little backfill, how old were you when you first took the co-gig?
I think I just turned 20.
Okay, so for the 2 years since high school, you were still living at home. Were you making any money playing music?
We were making enough money to be content. We weren't making very much money. It was not sustainable, but it was at that time, it felt like a pretty good life. A friend of mine named Matt Sluter, he and I had a house together of our own that we rented for like $200 a month or something. But I was only there about 6 months. And then that's when I got the offer to go on the road and wound up leaving. Like I said, at the time, it just seemed like a step up. And so I had to try it and see what happened.
Okay, you say you were totally unprepared. Amplify that.
Well, his music, lifestyle, entourage, persona, everything was a whole nother world. You know, I was this little genteel hippie kid from Asheville, and I was thrust into this world of bikers and rowdy craziness, which, I guess education comes in all forms, right?
Well, first, musically, did you have any, because obviously you have to be anxious. Did you have any problem fitting in with the band?
Well, we had a phone conversation, and I didn't consider myself cocky, so to speak. I was pretty shy, but I guess I was somewhat cocky on the phone. He said, I'm looking for a guitar player. And I said, well, I don't really consider myself a country guitar player, and I'm not really looking to be a country guitar player. And he said, well, I'm looking for a blues rock guitar player to add an edge to my music. And I said, well, if you're saying that I can play like myself, then I might be interested. But if you want me to play like somebody else, I'm not interested. And he liked that. And he said, I think you're going to be just fine.
This is Co himself or your buddy?
Yeah, it was him himself, who I had never met, knew nothing about. And, so I flew to Baton Rouge. I took one guitar with me. The airlines lost my guitar. And on the phone, he had said, I said, I don't know any of your songs. And he said, well, come sit in the audience for two or three nights or stand backstage and listen to the show. And after a few nights, you should be ready to play. And I didn't realize that he was completely lying to me. I got there, they lost my guitar. I went to sound check and I was bitching and cussing. And he said, what's wrong? And I said, the airlines lost my guitar. And he said, well, that's okay. When we play tonight, you can play one of mine. And I said, well, what do you mean? I'm going to sit and listen to the show for a few days. And he's like, oh, no, I changed my mind. You're on tonight. And so I went on stage and played a bunch of songs I'd never heard before. And that was my audition.
And were you replacing someone or adding flavor?
I was, unbeknownst to me, I was the only guitar player. The other guitar player had quit, and it was me or nobody. So that was the situation, but he didn't tell me that.
Okay, you're on the road. The sex, the drugs, are you relatively innocent, and all of a sudden there's craziness? What's going on there?
Yeah, I mean, I knew some of that world from always being the youngest musician in every band I was ever in. And that was the case throughout my life up through joining the Allman Brothers up until Mark Quinones and O'Teal and Derek Trucks joined the Allman Brothers. Up until that point, I was the youngest person in every band I was ever in. So I saw a lot of debauchery that I wasn't connected to because in a lot of cases it was a bit overwhelming, but it kind of went with the territory. But I'd never seen anything like this. This was total mania. And I probably wanted to bail from the very beginning, probably from the first week, if not the first day. But I didn't want to give up. I didn't want to be like, no, I'm quitting. You know, I had to give it a shot. And of course, there were a lot of upsides to it. You know, being thrust into a world where I could make records for the first time, travel all over the country, go to Europe, all these things that I wanted to do. So it was a complete change for me, you know.
And are you a relative straight arrow, or are you the type who likes to drink and drug at least some point in your life?
I think I'm pretty straight arrow relatively speaking. You know, I've been alcohol free for 37 years or something like that, and it's not because it was ever a problem with me. It just wasn't my choice, and it wasn't something I was really that interested in.
And how about drugs?
Dabbled, but very little. You know, a lot of smoking pot.
Okay, and then you have to hit the last part of the trifecta. What about sex?
You know, less than average, I would say. You know, it was there was some enticement early on when you have no ties and connections to anything, but it just never was my thing.
So how long did you play with Co?
3 years, 3.5 years.
And how did that end?
I left his band in January of 84, and about 6 months later, he called me. We had not spoken for a long time, or since I quit, and he called me and said, "Hey, I'm making a new record. Do you want to come play on it?" And I said, "Yeah, sure." And he said, "You want to come back on the road?" And I said, "No." And so then for the next two or three records, he would call me and ask me to come in, but not for the whole record. He would just ask me to play on two or three songs, as opposed to prior when I played on the entire thing.
So you quit. What was the plan?
To go to Nashville, pursue a career as a studio musician. It was the closest town to Asheville that had a music scene, and in 5 hours I could be home in a car. So that part of it was kind of cool. I didn't know much about the whole studio world. And when I started trying to thrust myself into it, there was a lot of learning, but luckily I had learned a lot from being able to play on Co's records, because he used all studio musicians other than myself. And for a while, a pedal steel player also played on the records, but then he quit the situation as well. So I was learning from all these A-team studio pros that were the best in the business, a lot of which had moved there from Memphis and had played on, you know, all these great Memphis records, and some that had moved from LA, but a lot of local Nashville guys, and they were all just amazing at what they did. But it was another world from what I did. And so it was a lot to digest and a lot to learn. As I started getting better at it, and as I started getting more and more demand or more and more work offers, I started realizing it's not really what I want to do. I thought it was, but there wasn't enough being yourself. You know, it was too much of a chameleon type experience. You had to be what they wanted you to be at pretty much every moment, and I couldn't really deal with that.
So what was the next step?
I started, thanks to this girl named Kim Morrison, who was one of the people in Nashville that put together background vocal groups. She called me one day and said, "What do you think about being part of some background vocal sessions?" And I said, "Well, you'd have to show me the ropes, but yeah, sure." And so she did. And the next thing you know, I was spending more time in the studio singing background on other people's records and not playing guitar. And I did that for a couple of years, and I would talk to the producers and about, hey, I also play guitar. And the Nashville mentality is, oh, no, we got plenty of guitar players. You know, you're a singer. And so it was good for me in the way that I really learned a lot about singing harmony and adapting to any situation like that. And it was great vocal stamina training, because some days we'd sing for like 10 hours. And so I had met Dickie Betts along the way. I'd met him, I think, when I was 21, and had sat in with him when I was in Coe's band, and he had sat in with us. And we kind of had become friends, but we didn't see each other that often. And so one day Kim called me and said, I'm putting together a vocal group to sing background on Dickie Betts' record. Do you want to do it? And I'm like, absolutely. So I walked in the studio, and Dickie looked at me, and he's like, what are you doing here? And I was like, oh, I'm here to sing harmony. He's like, oh, you got a guitar? And I was like, no, I didn't bring a guitar. And he just kind of laughed and said, well, good, I didn't want to hear you play anyway. And just, you know, so we were just like joking around. But it planted this seed in his head, because one of the guys in his band, Marty Prevett, the bass player, had been kind of pushing Dickie to get me in his band. And so what I realized was they were making this kind of Nashville country record, and it wasn't very good. It was pretty stale and like an attempt at being commercial, but very generic. And I was happy to sing on it and reconnect with him. And then he called me out of the blue and said, hey man, I scrapped that record. He said, it just wasn't me. He said, let's get together and write some songs and make a rock and roll record. And so we started writing, and it turned into his record Pattern Disruptive. And that turned into me joining the Allman Brothers.
Okay. I know a lot of musicians, and it's frequently about relationships. They say, oh, so-and-so called, but they were big friends. Or as you say to the producer, hey, I also play the guitar. To what degree were you working it?
As far as?
Selling yourself, ingratiating yourself in the scene in order, or were you sitting at home waiting for the phone to ring?
Well, I've never been a super aggressive person, but someone told me when I first came to Nashville that you have to take every gig that's offered to you, and you have to take every session that's offered to you, because the worst one is going to lead you to something better. And so I found that to be true. I would go do these terrible gigs and these horrible recording sessions, but I would meet somebody that called me 3 months later and said, hey, I got this session or this gig. Do you want to do it? So in that way, I was open to whatever would happen. The final straw for doing those terrible gigs came for me when I got a call to do this this gig in a club, 5 sets a night, $25. So it's $5 a set. And we were in the parking lot during one of the breaks, and the club owner came up tapping his watch like, you boys been on break too long. And I thought, nah, I think I'm done with this. I don't care if this leads me to something else. I'm not doing this anymore. And so my roommate went down and played the gig the next night, and somebody fired a gun in the club. And I was like, well, it looks like I got out just in time. But, you know, I met a lot of great people through these situations that were far from ideal. But I think that's the way it works. If you're going to do that, you have to kind of open yourself up to everything. Eventually you meet more and more people that can help. You know, there's a guitar player in Nashville named Kenny Greenberg, and he
I know Kenny. That's what I thought you were going to mention. Okay.
Well, Kenny and I became friends, and he was kind of he was the first call guitar player for blues and rock sessions and stuff in Nashville, which at that time there were not many. It was much more country dominated than even it is now. But he and I became friends, and we did some gigs together and some sessions together. And he called me one day and said, "Hey, I get some overflow sometimes, sessions that I can't do. Can I give them to you if I can't do them?" And I was like, "Absolutely." I thought it was a really cool thing for him to do. He also recommended this gig that he couldn't do 2 weeks with the Nighthawks, the blues band, the Nighthawks. And I did that, and it was a blast. And Jimmy Hall was the singing and playing harmonica and saxophone. And Jimmy and I knew each other prior to that, but that's where we really became close. But those kind of relationships mean everything.
Okay, you go to work with Dickey. What are the details to being part of the reconstituted Allman Brothers?
Well, first, we wrote a bunch of songs and made his solo record. And during that whole time process, I had no clue that they were thinking of reforming the Allman Brothers. Every time it was ever brought up, it was met with a resounding no. That's never going to happen. They had vowed to never reform, and as far as I knew, that was going to remain the case. So we did Dickey's record. I was in his band for about 2.5 years. And then after his record, we did a tour promoting the record. Then there was a break. And I, at that time, I had gotten my first offer to sign a record deal of my own as a solo artist. So in my mind, that's what I was going to do.
Okay, well, slow down. How did that come about?
Well, it actually had been brewing for a while. I had made up my mind, I don't want to be a session musician. I either want to be in a band where I'm the singer or one of the singers, or I want to be a solo artist, but I can't do this anymore. And so I hired a manager, this guy named Doc Fields, who has passed away years ago. He was my first manager. And he started sending recordings out and getting interest from some record companies in me as an artist. I think I was 26 or 27. And when Dickey called me, there was already some things in the works, and I wasn't even sure I was going to be able to juggle all of it. And being a solo artist was very important to me, and I was up front with him and said, "Hey, I'm a huge fan, and I really, really want to do this, but I'm also getting this other offer that's very important, and I'm not sure I can make it all happen." We did make it work out, and I kind of put my record on hold for a long time to do his record and then to do the tour. And then when that was over, I thought, okay, now I'm going to start focusing on making a solo record. And then they called me and said, "We're putting the Allman Brothers back together, and we want you to join," which was a complete shock to me. I absolutely had no idea that it was coming. And I was like, "Ah, shit. Okay, I guess I'm going to have to postpone my record again, because there's no way I could turn that down."
And what year is that?
89.
So 89, at the time they put together the Allman Brothers, how many dates a year were they working then? Obviously, we're just getting back together.
Well, they had released this Dreams box set,
right,
for the 20th anniversary, and they wanted to do a tour in support of that. So it was a 20th anniversary tour promoting the box set, and it was only intended to be a one-time thing. Gullibly, maybe, I believed that I was going to go do this tour and go back to my life. I had no idea that they would, based on the success and the chemistry and the fact that everybody was getting along, that they would say, "Oh, let's do it again next year and the next year and the next year." It was a year-by-year thing. And I think it probably surprised everybody from the beginning. The chemistry of that band, that incarnation of the band, was pretty uncanny right from the beginning. The original members were getting along again. Everybody was playing great. The new members were fitting in well, and it was just coming together in a way that exceeded everybody's expectations. And I think the smartest thing that the band did was go back to the early stuff, the Duane Allman, Barry Oakley era stuff, and pattern everything around that, not worry so much about having to touch on every era of the band. They weren't so happy with the last few records they had made, so there was an instant decision to divorce themselves from that part of their career and try to get back to the original sound. I think they realized, because Dickie and I had several conversations, that even though they felt like they had backed out of the music business because they weren't welcome, they weren't really fitting into the current 80s situation. About by the late 80s, Stevie Ray Vaughan was doing great. The Grateful Dead were still doing great. Robert Cray. And I remember Dickie saying, somewhere in between all that stuff is us. So maybe it is time for us to come back. And so that's what happened.
Okay. How much of your year was working on the Allman Brothers, and what did you do with the rest of the time?
Less than half. We had more than 6 months to ourselves. So I was, you know, recording demos, writing songs, playing gigs, playing my music, and pursuing all sorts of stuff. And it was nice that I had that much free time around the Allman Brothers schedule. But the whole time thinking, well, I need to get in the studio, because years were going by without me making my first record. You know, I recorded my first record in 92 that I had been working on in my head since 87.
Okay, you join the Allman Brothers. Do they treat you right? Are you a member of the band?
Not a member from a business standpoint, you know, but I think a really smart decision on their part, which I would assume that they really had to look at it this way because of the music and the legacy of that band. It wasn't looked at on stage as like the original members and the new guys or the sidemen. It was a band. Everybody was meant to contribute 100%. You know, a lot of bands that reformed, you would have the original members visually would be the band and everybody else would be like the hired guns. But that was never meant to be what the Allman Brothers was. So from the very beginning, the latitude that they gave us all was tremendous. You know, input, plenty of space to play. In that way, I felt extremely included. And I was writing songs, co-writing with Dickie. They were, I sang a song on the first record. I sang a song on the second record. You know, there was like the third record. And I felt like in the situation I was in, they were really respectful of my situation.
So then Dickie gets kicked out of the band. Give us your take on that. I know it's dicey, but.
Yeah, that was, there was a lot of water under the bridge, but between 89 and that, when Government Mule formed in late 94, Woody and I had no thoughts of leaving the Allman Brothers, so to speak. We were just doing a side project. But at that time, the Allman Brothers, the original members, were not getting along so well, and there was no writing, no rehearsing, no recording, no communicating for that matter. And so in Government Mule, all those things were flourishing. And so it was, the balance was shifting. So eventually we felt like we needed to leave the Allman Brothers in order to be taken seriously as Government Mule, because it was turning into something more than a side project. So in 97, Woody and I left the Allman Brothers, and it wasn't until, I guess, 99 that they kicked Dickie out, which, so I wasn't around for that. And that's a really touchy subject for everybody, but for myself, Dickie's the one that gave me the opportunity. He's the one that brought me into the band. He brought me into his band. He brought me into the Allman Brothers. He insisted that I be a big part of the writing process and the creative process. And I, you know, I feel like I owe him a huge part of my career.
And when was the last time you talked to him?
Last time I talked to him was when he played Peach Fest. And we spoke briefly, but I listened to his set, and I guess that's been about a year ago.
Okay. You know, forgetting all the things that were said, one of the discussions is that he was bipolar and would sort of leave the boat for a while. Did you experience that in your time with him?
Well, suffice to say, the Allman Brothers was plagued with plenty of issues along those lines. It's not really my place to examine or report on that. I knew the history of the band before I joined, and it extended far beyond any problems Dickie might have, you know. But there was a lot of drama, for sure. I mean, you know, there was a time period when Greg and Dickie couldn't or wouldn't communicate, and so Dickie would come to me and say, "Hey, Warren, I can't talk to Greg. Will you talk to him about this?" And then Greg would come to me and say, "Man, I can't talk to Dickie. Will you talk to him about this?" And I was literally push me, pull you in the middle and trying to kind of be Switzerland and not take sides, but and trying to just speak my mind, but also to stay out of age old family feuds that had been there for a long, long time.
So, yes, Government Mule started as a side project. Two questions. Why is it Government Mule, and why is government spelled G-O-V apostrophe T?
All right. So this story is a little less politically correct as time goes on, but we were looking for a name for our band. And the only thing we had thought of was Drag Strip Courage, which was from a Tom Waits song. And we didn't like it, but it was the best thing we had thought of, and we're all big Tom Waits fans. So the Allman Brothers were headlining one night of Memphis in May, which is the Beale Street Festival in Memphis. And we were headlining one night, and James Brown was headlining the next night. So the Allman Brothers entourage left after the show and traveled from Memphis to Atlanta. Alan Woody, the bass player, who was in Government Mule and in the Allman Brothers, and J-Mo, one of the two original drummers in the Allman Brothers, stayed behind to see James Brown. And there was a part of the show where James was waltzing with his, what they determined later to be his wife. And J-Mo was referring to her anatomy, and he pointed and said to Woody, "Is that James's wife?" And Woody said, "Yeah, I think so." And he said, "Shit, Government Mule." And he was referring to the size of her ass. Unbeknownst to either of us, in Gulfport, Mississippi, which is where J-Mo is from, that was a term. And so Woody called me and said, "I think I have the name for our band." So we're named after James Brown's wife's big ass.
And why the apostrophe? Why not the full spelling?
It was like, you know, when you rubber stamp government on some
right
crate somewhere, you know. I'm not sure why we chose that. You know, names are funny. You know, I don't know any band name that would be good if the band wasn't good. But it haunted us in some ways, because when we would go overseas, they would say, "So what does it mean, Govt Mule?" And what? Govt Mule, what does it mean? Oh, well, G-O-V apostrophe T means government, and mule, we were referring to the 40 acres and a mule and that whole thing, you know, and there was a song on the first record that talked about that. But in a lot of places, it went completely over people's heads. And we didn't talk about where the name came from for a long time because James's wife passed away, and it seemed inappropriate to talk about, even under any circumstances, probably. But then a few years ago, Matt Epps, our drummer, spilled the beans. So we used to always just say, oh, whatever you think it means, that's what it means, you know.
Okay, so you start this side project. You're done with the Allman Brothers. Does Government Mule, are you essentially starting over, or enough people know you that it's happening? To what degree is the success, is there a success in your eyes at the beginning?
Well, I think more so than we expected, more recognition than we expected to happen so soon, because our first record was meant to be a side project. It was meant to be a really low-budget, experimental, improvisation-oriented type record in the beginning, even more so than it wound up being. By the time we actually got a record deal and a producer and a studio and all that stuff, I'd written more and more songs, so it became more of a song-oriented record. But in the beginning, I wanted it to be very psychedelic and low pressure. You know, I'd been listening a lot to this record by Pat Metheny and Roy Haynes and Dave Holland called Question and Answer. And I read in the liner notes that they went into the studio, played a bunch of songs one time, never played a second take, never listened back to anything. And then he went back into the studio a couple of weeks later and went, yes, yes, no, yes, no. And wow. That's the way that they made that record. And so that was kind of what I thought we should do for the first Government Mule record. By the time all the red tape had been dealt with, it was turning into something more than that. And I'm glad, because I like the more song-oriented aspect of it. You know, but in the beginning, we were just doing something for fun. We had no aspirations on leaving the Allman Brothers or doing a second record or doing a second tour. We were just doing something for the fun of it. The way it came about was myself and Alan Woody and Greg Allman used to share a tour bus, and we listened to a lot of music on the bus as opposed to the other band bus where nobody listened to music. And we one day we were listening to Cream or Hendrix or something, and Woody commented, you know, nobody does this anymore. The whole power trio, improvisational trio, rock trio thing, nobody's done that. And I was like, yeah, you're right. And he said, you know, with the right drummer, you and I could do that. And I thought of Matt Apps. And so that's where the idea was born. But again, just something for fun with very little ambition. As it changed into something else, then our priorities changed.
Okay. But if that, you ultimately say, we're not working with the Allman Brothers, we're working with Government Mule. Correct?
Yeah. Yeah.
So how did they pull you back in, the Allman Brothers?
Well, everything was, for Government Mule, was really going great. And from a creative standpoint, from a business standpoint, we had made three records. The band was progressing musically all the time. And then Alan Woody passed away unexpectedly in 2000. So at that point, I felt like Government Mule was finished, that we were done. And it took me a long time to wrap my head around even the concept of trying to replace him and trying to continue on. But it's hard enough to replace any founding member. But in a trio, I think it's even harder, because in a trio, each person is kind of, depending on their personality, to be a third of the music. You know, when you look at Cream and the Hendrix Experience, and even bands like Led Zeppelin and Free that were a trio plus a singer, or The Who, or Mountain, you know, all these bands, the bass player and the drummer were having, just by the nature of it, to have a much more aggressive role, which implied the need for a lot of personality to come from those characters, you know. And Alan Woody was absolutely the perfect character for that. That's why we started the band in the first place. So I was ready to end Government Mule. The first two phone calls I got were from Phil Lesh, who said, "Man, I feel so bad. I know what it's like to lose someone that you have a profound musical relationship with." And that was a very heartfelt call. And the second call was from Greg, who he and Woody were very close. They were riding motorcycles together. There was a lot of camaraderie on our bus, and he was feeling the loss in a very similar way to mine, but he understood my loss, and he said, "How are you doing?" And I said, "Well, you know, I'm still having these dreams, like where he's in the dream." And just before he even thought about it, he said, "Oh, you're always going to have those." And I was like, wow. Till that moment, I didn't understand that he had those all the time, you know. But not during that phone call, but in one of the later phone calls, he said, "Sure love to have you back in the Allman Brothers." And so I thought, well, maybe I should give it a try, you know. So we agreed to book the Beacon Theater for a run, and they were going to call it the Allman Brothers with special guest Warren Haynes. So if it didn't work out, it wouldn't look like I had rejoined and then quit. So we did that, and the chemistry from the beginning, everybody sounded great. Everybody was in great spirits. And at that time, I was thinking, I can't really continue with Government Mule. And so I found myself back in the Allman Brothers. And I'm really glad that happened. Keeping Government Mule together was a whole nother thing. We came up with this idea, which was born out of this dinner that we had. We had dinner with myself, my wife, Matt Apps, Alan Woody's wife, and Michael Barbiero, our producer. And somebody said, "Well, if you were going to make a record, who would you want to play bass?" And I said, "Jack Bruce." "No, seriously." "John Entwistle." "No, seriously." "Chris Squire." "No." And then we thought, well, why don't we ask each of these guys to play one song? And so that's how the whole Deep End concept came about. We thought, let's go to all Alan Woody's favorite bass players, and which are mostly our favorite bass players too, and ask them all if they'll be involved in this record. You know, so we spent this therapeutic time in the studio every day, a new favorite legendary bass player standing where Alan Woody used to stand. And that's the way that we forced ourselves to kind of get back in the game. It was cathartic. It was bittersweet because there were these moments of absolute joy mixed in with all the pain. And more than anything, it was an opportunity to reinvent ourselves, because I started thinking, okay, I've got to write a song for Bootsy Collins. I've got to write a song for Jack Bruce. I've got to write a song for Larry Graham. You know, all these things that I didn't just want to have people come in and play on any Government Mule song. I wanted them to play on a song that they could insert their personalities into. And so by doing that, we were able to kind of expand the sound of Government Mule and the concept of Government Mule to include all these other influences that we all had anyway, but had never been part of our band before.
Okay, so you have that track, that train running down the track. You have the Allman Brothers. The Allman Brothers turned the Beacon into quite a month there in March in New York City. At what point do you say, just staying on the Allman Brothers tip, at what point do you say, I can't do this, I have to do my own thing?
You mean at the very end?
At the very end.
Well, I'm glad you asked me that, because that's not really what happened. That story was so misconstrued in the press. I've told this story before, and Derek's told it before, but it seems to be, I guess it's hard to get it to cut through all the noise, but the entire band had been talking about picking an end date. We're not going to do this forever. A lot of the original members felt like at some point, and the new members as well, we all felt like the Allman Brothers isn't a band that can just go play the hits and go through the motions, play the same songs every night the same way. The band has never been about that. It's always been an improvisational band that gives 110% and leaves everything on the stage every night. And in the event that we can't do that anymore, rather than go out there and watch it deteriorate and get worse and worse year after year, then let's be aware of it and pick a time when we're going to do the last tour, the last show. And everybody was on board with that concept. We were going to do the final show at Madison Square Garden. And I think initially it was going to be on Duane Allman's birthday. And, you know, we had made all these plans together, the entire band. As the end date got closer and closer, some people started getting cold feet and saying, I don't think I want to go through with this. I think we would like to keep it going. And it was only, you know, one or two people that felt that way. Everybody else was pretty committed to staying with the original concept. But when we would get together and have these meetings about what about keeping it going longer, well, Derek Trucks and myself had made plans. We had booked ourselves far beyond that concept, and it would mean completely disrupting everything that we had on the books and going against everything that we were doing. And we all, for the most part, still agreed that it was the right thing to do. So Butch had gone on this cruise and said to a panel that the Allman Brothers was going to continue, but that Derek was no longer going to be part of it, or something to that effect. And he didn't realize that there was a Rolling Stone writer on the cruise that was part of that. And so as soon as they docked, the guy called Bert Holman, the Allman Brothers manager, and said, "What's going on?" Bert called Derek. Derek called me, and we're like, "Well, you know, we're all on the same page, aren't we? Aren't we continuing with this plan?" And so Derek said, "Well, I think I should just put out a press release saying that I'm leaving the band, because I can't do this. I have all this other stuff committed to that I'm not willing to change." And I'm not speaking for Derek, but this is the way it went down. And he and I had kind of always made a pact. If you go, I go. We had always felt that way, that I didn't want to be in the band without him. He didn't want to be in the band without me. And I think most of us kind of felt like this is the last version of the Allman Brothers. We shouldn't water it down and take a chance on deteriorating it by creating yet another incarnation this far down the line. And so he said, "Well, I think that's what we should do." And I said, "Well, if you're going to do that, then let's do it together. Let's just put out a dual press release saying that this is what's happening." And it was really unfortunate, because we tried to take advantage of the opportunity to tell people in the media that that's what was happening, but it was very awkward and uncomfortable. So I never did feel like I was leaving the band, and Derek never did either. We were just going through with the plan that we had for several years.
Okay. How did you end up playing with the Dead and Phil Lesh?
Phil Lesh called me in the late 90s and said that he had put together a list of musicians that he wanted to work with and that I was on that list. And was I interested in coming to California for a few days rehearsal and do a couple of shows and see what happened? And I said, absolutely. So I flew to California. We rehearsed for a couple of days. We did two shows, and it was a blast. I really enjoyed it. And that was the beginning of a very long-running, beautiful relationship. It turned into me eventually being asked to tour with the Dead in 2003 and in 2009. And I really love that experience. You know, I love all those guys. I'm really honored to be part of that family and part of that that musical family, I guess. It's unfortunate that there was a lot of tension among the original members during the tours. There was a chance it was going to go longer and probably could have and maybe should have, but it wasn't meant to be. And having dealt with the Allman Brothers in a similar fashion, I respect that. You know, when things are not gelling on the road, these bands have histories that predate everything. And so, you know, whenever there's tension and drama, it usually has something to do with something that happened a long, long time ago.
Okay. Well, needless to say, the Allman Brothers are history. And Phil Lesh does not go on tour. Where does this leave Warren Haynes?
You know, those years that I juggled so much, so many balls, like there was one year I did the Allman Brothers and Mule and the Dead, and I didn't think it was possible. I went to my wife and said, you know, I have this situation and it's being offered to me. I don't see any way of making it work. And she was like, slow down. Do you want to look back and think I had this opportunity, but I said no? And I was like, yeah, maybe not. You know. So we did a lot of, communicating, a lot of behind the scenes with all the camps working together to make things work out in a way that wasn't ideal for any of the situations, but worked for everybody. So when that load was removed, it made things a bit more normal for me. You know, I really embraced and enjoyed at the time working to the extent that I was. I love that. You know, there's nothing I love more than playing music. And I look at it like an athlete. You know, when you're on top of your game and there's a demand and you got a great team or two great teams or three great teams that you're lucky enough to be part of, then yeah, let's make hay when the sun's shining. You know, I really felt wonderful about all that stuff. But then when it was finally over, I'm like, oh, it is kind of nice to be home for a minute, you know. These days, you know, prior to the coronavirus, which leads us back to where we were, I work pretty much the amount of time that I feel comfortable with. And you know, if I work less, I start to get a little antsy. And I don't need to work more than I have been. It's been a pretty rigorous schedule, which I enjoy. But, you know, another way I would compare it to being an athlete is like, you know, I'm 60 years old. I'm very happy that I've had the career that I've had and had the opportunities that I've had. And I want to be like John Lee Hooker playing when I'm 80. But at the same time, there are windows that we're confronted with. You know, you're not going to be able to do what you do in the prime of your life for every year of your life. And so I've always felt like things kind of dwindle at their own pace and whatever slowing down occurs, it occurs because it needs to, and it's the right thing. And I feel it's very organic, you know.
So to the 100 to 120 dates a year you do now, how many of those are government mule and what are the other ones?
Mostly mule. You know, I do a handful of solo acoustic shows. I do a handful of shows with Phil Lesh and a handful of other things where something really interesting will come along. You know, I did the last waltz tour, which was a blast. But Government Mule is the main priority, and any work as a solo artist beyond that. You know, I'm really looking forward to making another solo record, but I'm also looking forward to making another Mule record. You know, I feel like I'm so lucky as a songwriter. I'm lucky in every aspect of my career. I'm just really grateful for the opportunities that I've had. It really kind of played out exactly like I hoped, in a way that one could never predict or expect. But I'm lucky in the way that I write all these songs. Some of them are not meant to be Government Mule songs. Some of them were not meant to be Allman Brothers songs. Some of them maybe are not intended for me. But the fact that I have all these different outlets, and that, you know, maybe somebody else will wind up recording it, or maybe I just wrote it for the gratification of writing the song. You know, when all those situations were happening, I would find myself writing for the sake of the song. And when the song was written, as we talked about earlier, then I would think, oh, is this a Mule song? Could this be an Allman Brothers song? Or is this something I would do on one of my solo records? But I never wanted to think about that during the writing process. I wanted to wait and back up away from it and figure it out after the fact.
So at this point, and don't be humble, what is the dream? What is it that you want to achieve? Certainly you can play, but what is the goal now, whether you achieve it or not?
Well, it probably sounds stupid to say, but I don't think I've made my best record, and I don't think I've written my best song. The goal for me is to keep going in a way that I feel like I'm breaking new ground, because I've been really lucky to have that opportunity to keep not repeating myself. You know, somebody asked me, like, role models, not so much role models in a humanitarian way, but role models in a career way, or a history way, or a music way. Miles Davis, to me, the fact that he was constantly reinventing himself, and by the time people got used to his new music, he was already thinking about something else that they weren't going to get used to for another couple of years. That's been such a wonderful example for all of us that I can only take a small amount of that advice for in the parameters that I'm given. But I think of it like that. I think, you know, I don't want to redo what I've already done. And as musicians, we don't really have a lot of choice in that matter. And I somehow have managed to have a little more choice than the average person, you know, to make those decisions that I'm not going to remake my first record or my second record or my third record. I'm going to make something that's completely different. And if people get it, great, you know, but it's something I need to do.
Well, just staying on that point, how lucrative has your career been?
I have no complaints whatsoever. You know, I've been successful as a musician, as an artist, as a songwriter. You know, and lucky enough to have written songs for people that, you know, like when I wrote Two of a Kind, Working on a Full House for Garth Brooks. When I co-wrote that song, had no idea that it was going to become such a huge number one song that would keep generating income for years to come. And I'm very thankful for that. George Jones recorded one of my songs, and he's one of my heroes. So even aside from the money part of it, I was just so honored to have people like George Jones and John Mayall that I grew up listening to record my tunes. You know, it's there's some gratification from that that's beyond the business part of it.
Okay. Needless to say, while you've been on this path, the whole business has changed. Certainly the business element, but also the music element. Certainly you were there at the right time when jam band scene was very big, early to mid 90s. There's certainly a scene at this point in time, but it is not the dominant popular music. You're essentially a rock artist. How do you feel about being a rock artist in a world where all the hype and a great, certainly percentage of the recording revenue goes to pop and hip hop?
Well, you know, I have to look at it in a similar way to the way jazz artists have looked at their entire lives. You do what you do because you love it. And if there are times when it's in vogue, then that's great. And I've had more of those times than I could hope for. But I've never felt like I could change what it is that I love because I feel like it's not mainstream or not enough people would support it. You know, I remember maybe it was Wynton Marsalis, somebody said about jazz that they asked him a similar question. And he said, well, you have to realize that what we're doing is filet mignon. A lot of people would prefer to eat at McDonald's.
And that's pretty definitive. The other thing, of course, that's been changed is that you say, you know, the tour used to be the advertisement for the album. Now the album's the advertisement for the tour. How is the shift to touring? Let me put it a different way. If you had to choose, or maybe with percentage, are you more about the live experience or more about the studio writing experience?
Well, I can answer both of those. If I had to choose, the live experience is more gratifying, you know, because for me, improvisation, which is just momentary composition, that's my most favorite thing as a musician. Now, as a songwriter, it's a little different. As a singer, it's a little different, but performing is still always going to win out for me. The business part of it, you know, we were always one of those bands, and the Allman Brothers, Government Mule, all the bands in that sort of scene were always one of those bands that touring generated the better income. So when that changed, it wasn't a huge change for us like it was for bands that were selling millions and millions of records. So we were maybe ahead of it a little bit because that's what we had always done. It is a little tough when they start taking a zero away from all the budgets. And, you know, it used to be if a band sold 1 million records, well, now they're selling 100,000. If they sold 100,000, now they're selling 10,000.
Right.
So, you know, and budgets are corresponding with that, you know. In the 70s, bands were making records, spending like $500,000 on a record. And then you fast forward to now, and you got to make a record for 20 grand. It's challenging, and it means we're never going to get Dark Side of the Moon or Steely Dan Asia or Fleetwood Mac Rumors. We're never going to get those records ever again unless something changes in a way that would allow that to present itself, you know, because bands don't have the opportunity. Artists don't have the opportunity. Even if you have a home studio, A, it's not going to be as good as the studios those records were made in. And B, you don't have a year and a half to make a record, or 6 months or whatever, you know, some of those records took. I love making records, but playing live is definitely, well, it's more fun because making records is tedious. Making records it's not so much the creative side of your brain at work all the time. It's more work and less play. You know, when you're performing, the ultimate thing you can do is to shut your brain off and go on autopilot where you're not thinking at all. And that's something that you try to do in the studio, but it's not as achievable.
So what is your favorite Allman Brothers song to play?
Maybe Dreams. I really love playing Dreams. Whip and Post is great because you can take it anywhere you want to go. You know, sometimes we would stop in the middle and go off to a uncharted territory and nobody would even know how it was going to come back. And the same with songs like In Memory of Elizabeth Reed. But there's so many great songs in the catalog. Just playing the song itself sometimes is a joyous feeling as well, you know. But I love the ones that we can reinterpret on a given night.
So, you know, you do a great version of Don Henley's Wasted Time. Are you someone who's very broad in your musical knowledge and musical taste? Because many people would poo-poo that music relative to the Allman Brothers music.
Yeah, my taste runs extremely wide. I love so many types of music, and I try not to be a snob about the actual music that I like on a song-by-song basis. I can be a snob about, let's say it differently. I want to open myself to every genre, and whatever the best is in that genre, I'm open to. And for the most parts, I think that's true. You have to take it, like if I hear music, you either like it or you don't like it, you know, and I'm definitely not the dude from Big Lebowski. I hate the fucking Eagles, man. I'm not that. Although I love the dude, and I know it's not. Maybe it's not hip to say this, but nobody can deny a lot of the great songs that those guys wrote. Oh,
unbelievable! I'm a huge fan,
and. The poppy stuff is incredible on its own merit. But then when you talk about songs like Wasted Time, that wasn't written to be a pop song.
Right.
That's just a great, well-crafted song.
You can go on with your life, baby, and I can go on with mine. Just for the first time I heard that lyric, wow.
And the other day I thought about, which I think I did solo acoustic once or twice, the song Last Resort.
Right.
That's not meant to be a pop song. It's just a beautiful song, and nobody can deny that.
To what degree do you keep up on new music?
I wish it was more, and I'm sure some of it's my fault, but I blame a lot of it on the new music itself because it's really hard for me to connect to most of it. When I hear something that I like, I'm really grateful and I'm open to it. But a lot of it, I think, is just aspiring to lowest common denominator, lowering the bar. People are selling out at every turn. The thought process from the very beginning is, what can I do to get more likes or make more money or get more attention or sell more records or more streaming or more downloading or whatever? It should start with the music, and all that should be secondary, you know. When you start compromising your music before you even make it, I think you're looking at it backwards. There are things I like.
How did the 50th anniversary Allman Brothers gig come together? You had a rousing reception. Is that a one-off, or do you think there'll be anything like that in the future?
It came together because J-Mo called all of us and said, we need to do a 50th anniversary show. And it was the opportunity to do that show at Madison Square Garden that we never did, that we had talked about being the final show before. It's always been our intent for it to be a one-off and not do it again. The odd thing is, after all this coronavirus and the new norm, I don't know, A, if it would even be possible to do it on the other side, and B, would we look at it differently, more favorably, less favorably? I don't really know, but our intent was always for that to be the finality and be done with it.
Well, this has been wonderful, Warren. We look forward to you being back on the boards and certainly your new recordings. Thanks so much for doing this.
My pleasure. Nice talking to you.
Till next time, this is Bob Lefsetz.